Jay Idrick.
All right, thank you, and good afternoon, or good morning, I should say. We're going to do an overview of ATSC, ATSC 3.0, that is, and the slides that I'm presenting from are slides that were developed last spring for the ATSC 3.0 boot camp. So, questions about what's the goal of ATSC 3.0? What problems are we trying to solve? Well, we're trying to improve the viewing experience, better quality, more accessibility, personalization, interactivity, addressing the changing consumer behavior and their preferences for receiving content, and adding value to the broadcasting's service platform, extending the reach, adding new business models, all without the restriction of backward compatibility. We've done some things to ATSC 1.0 along the way, which were all backward compatible, but it's now time to kind of erase the blackboard and start over and not worry about backward compatibility. So why is all this worth it? Well, technology marches on. You'd point out that by 2016, the standard will have been in use for 20 years, but the actual underlying technology in some of these cases goes all the way back to the very early 90s. So we're already over the 20-year point, and that's in the digital world, that's quite old. Audience expectations are growing. They want more. New competition and disruptive forces in the industry are causing broadcasters to lose eyeballs to other delivery methods. And of course, we've got this thing called spectrum. We're always looking for a better way to use spectrum, particularly under the pressure that we're going to go through here with a spectrum auction. And leveraging the power of over-the-air with online. Over-the-air has a lot of distinct advantages. There have been a number of examples, particularly in emergencies, where over-the-air survived and online did not. So why should broadcasters care? Well, maintaining and building an audience, putting content where the viewers are, so mobility and devices that are portable, benefiting from new technologies, quantitative and qualitative growth, and developing new revenue streams. Unlike the period between the initial launch of ATSC 1.0 and the start of 3.0, we had kind of waning participation by broadcasters. We've got our standard, we'll just, you know, kind of drop by the wayside and just do our thing. But with the advent of 3.0 and the recognition by broadcasters that this is an important thing, we've had many broadcast groups that have rejoined or joined ATSC and attend and participate in the specialty group and the ad hoc groups that are formed to cover these topics. We've had some broadcast groups that have gone out and hired experts. There are industry experts that know things like RF testing and performance, levels of coding, management layers, coding layers, etc. And these experts are generally consultants who have been in the business, have worked on these areas of specialty. And it's not expected that many of the CTOs in broadcast groups are real experts in this area. So a group of broadcasters banded together, formed a consortium, and they went out and hired some experts to represent them in these activities. And then we've had this thing called NAB Lab, and NAB Lab has become active, and they're helping to lead and represent the broadcasters in the process. Through that, the broadcasters have provided guidance as to what they want. They want an OFDM physical layer. Why? Because of mobility. They want an IP core. They want compatibility with the delivery systems that we're seeing over the internet, through wireless, and other delivery systems. So IP core is essential. They want flexible and evolvable applications and management layers to be able to support the future, be able to add things that come along as technology progresses. Cross-layer control channel to be able to harmonize the physical layer, the management layer, the presentation layer, and be able to tie all of these things together on an effective manner. The broadcasters got together and did a poll and came up with their list of the order of importance for the platform and for the applications, what's needed. So robustness, number one. Mobile coverage, number two. Flexible use of spectrum, number three. Advanced and targeted advertising. Advanced accessibility for services, and advanced emergency alerting. These are all things that the broadcasters feel are very important and need to be part of the platform. In terms of the applications, there need to be the ability to do hybrid services, ultra high definition, personalization and interactivity, multi-view and multi-screen delivery, enhanced and immersive audio, and 3D content should also be capable of being presented. So let's do an overview of the system. Going back to ATSC 1.0, the 1.0 got bolted on when we started progressing with the additions to the original ATSC system. It was all about a 6 megahertz channel, about being able to maintain channel branding, being all digital, fitting in 19.39 megabits of payload, being able to deliver multiple programs, one video per program that's either SD or HD, multiple audios, but it was problematic to be able to do two, so multi-language was a problem, and being able to deliver surround and closed captioning, but not have any new training for the viewer. So then what we did was we bolted on mobile, known as A153, and there was a development program for some of these additional services, which became known as ATSC 2.0. 2.0 work has pretty much been completed. It's in the implementation phase, but in reality, 2.0's development is largely a precursor for 3.0, where many of the things that were developed in 2.0 end up being transported over to the 3.0 development. So 3.0, again, we're dealing with 6 megahertz, but the PHY layer, the physical layer that delivers the bits, is scalable to other channel bandwidths. So we could do ATSC 3.0 in 7 megahertz, in 8 megahertz, or perhaps even a reduced bandwidth. Flexible use, being able to do fixed and mobile, a combination of both. Being able to have some broadband delivery as part of the mix, providing multiple services, wide range of viewing devices. One video per service is possible, but greater than one video is also possible. Multiple audio, being able to do various languages, as well as being able to personalize the audio and for it to be immersive, meaning that we've got far more than 5.1 channels to be able to create an immersive atmosphere. Of course, captioning and pushed content and interactivity, being flexible and evolvable. So the question within ATSC was how to organize all this activity and be able to develop it and manage it and make sure that everything comes together. And it all begins with modulation and the RF, or what we know as the physical layer. Then we bolt on transport, encapsulation of data, and the surrounding metadata that delivers the message. And finally, we have coding, presentation, runtime. And with that, we divide it into layers. So we've got a physical layer, we've got a management and protocol layer, and we've got an applications and presentation layer. But in order to do the right thing, we had to know what are the requirements for the system. So we have a specialty group that's focused on system requirements and also on program management of the whole process for development. And within the numbering sequence of ATSC, we call those groups specialty groups. So we have a specialty group or a specialist group on the system requirements and management called S31. S32 is focused on the physical layer, S33 on management and protocol, and S34 on applications and presentation. Later, after we got well into the process, it was recognized that we really needed to look at the overall system and what the implications are when we bolt all of these parts together into a final system. So we added an additional specialist group called the ATSC 3.0 Ecosystem Group. And their job is to model and evaluate the environment for deployment, to examine the various types of content and functionality that are going to be impacting on a fully operational 3.0 system. I'll just give you a quick sample of some of their work. Here's a look at video streaming, whether it be video streaming over the top or the broadband delivery or video streaming via the broadcast channel. This is kind of what they think it will look like in a 1 to 5 year window after 3.0 is deployed. But then they also look beyond the 5 year point in time and how it might evolve. And as you see, it's very heavily IP oriented. So let's begin with the physical layer and do an overview there. So we're going to look at some basic building blocks, if you will, OFDM, FEC, forward error correction. We'll talk a little bit about Shannon's theorem and what BER might mean. So OFDM, instead of using a single carrier that's modulated like we have in 8VSB, there's a group of carriers that are equally spaced and frequency division multiplexed across the channel. The values of all of these subcarriers of interest are zero at the correct frequency. It enables efficient use of the spectrum. One of the key features is the fact that there's a guard interval between the individual subcarriers, and that guard interval allows the removal of what we call inter-symbol interference that can be caused by fading and multipath and some of the other factors that impair an RF path. Forward error correction is all about adding robustness to the channel, taking care of lost elements of the signal. And if we look at the chart to the right-hand side of the picture, we compare where DVB-T2 is today, DTMB, ISDBT, which is the Japanese and Brazilian system, and finally the current ATSC system. So you'll see that the DVB-T2 and the newer systems that came on after ATSC all employ different types of coding from what we had available to us at the time that ATSC 1.0 was developed. And of course, 1.0 was based around Reed-Solomon and convolutional coding, whereas we've got BCH and LDPC that are much more efficient and robust code systems. Claude Shannon and a fellow by the name of Hartley both worked for Bell Labs, and they came up with this mathematical theorem that basically said that the system capacity of a channel was a function of the average receive power versus the average noise, and factored in the bandwidth of the channel. So the capacity system increases as the carrier to noise, or some people would call it signal to noise, but it's more commonly referred to as carrier to noise, increases. Bit error rate is a measure of how clean our demodulated digital signal can be from the file layer, expressed as errors per second. For IP, it's really packet error rate that is more of a concern. So in the real world, we've got a transmission system, we've got viewers, and we've got a lot of impairments out there. It might be a dense populated area like this with tall buildings that are going to create multipath, where signals are reflected off of buildings, could be even worse. And it's not just limited to urban areas, but you get out into areas where you've got terrain differences, you've got a lot of other obstructions that might cause all of these multipath problems. So the environment, its geometry, will determine the channel conditions, and the system needs to be able to combat this. So the technology to combat this begins with OFDM, with the guard intervals that easily remove these effects of multipath, and then adding strong forward error correction coding, parameterization to account for Doppler and low signal strength, so you can tweak the various handles of the modulation and be able and also the coding and be able to come up with a combination that best works for the type of delivery that you're trying to achieve. Then there's single frequency networking, the ability to have signals arrive from different directions. So in essence, you get diversity reception. And the ability to have a system that's extensible, to add on, bolt on future technology as the improvements occur. So here's Shannon's curve, Shannon's theorem plotted out. And I know it's pretty difficult to look at here, but you can see all of the different modes of DVB and ISDBT and DTMB and LTE, and including A53, our current ATSC 1.0, and see where they stack up against the Shannon's theory. Our goal with 3.0 is to get as close to the line, the curve, and the line on the theory as possible, so that we can take advantage of the robustness of the system, be able to deliver a maximum amount of bandwidth given the various parameters. So S32, the group on physical layer, they recognize that there are a lot of elements. So they divided up into ad hoc groups. So S32 is actually made up today of four different ad hoc groups, one on common system elements, one on modulation encoding, one on the waveform, and finally we have one started out to be a group on mobile, placing emphasis on mobile, but because of rights issues in broadcasting, particularly the difference we have today in A153, where mobile is a separate channel, broadcasters recognize that one signal needed to be able to reach all of the different types of platforms. And that way you get around the rights issues. So the group recognized that they shouldn't really be focused on mobile, but rather on the core delivery of the signal. So they renamed themselves the Core Broadcast Service Group. Management and protocol layers, again, we're looking at management and protocol in S33. S33 go back to 1.0. 1.0 is based around an MPEG-2 transport stream. We have in the management and protocol layer the program multiplexing, the clock reference for locking up the various elements of the system, audio-video synchronization, and then we have this thing called PSIP, which is the metadata that describes what is being sent. So 2.0, which is the enhancement to the 1.0 system, brought in the use of the internet and the ability to bolt on some interactivity, personalization, audience measurement, and adding other things like local storage on devices, so you can do non-real time those types of factors, as well as the use of new codecs. So in 2.0, we added 264 MPEG-4 capabilities to the system so that new codecs could be, and better, more efficient codecs could be used. Part of the 2.0 effort, but treated somewhat separately, was the development of mobile. And here we see the all the various elements that make up the mobile layer known as A153. So in 3.0, it was kind of re-examined and broken down into the following categories. And the ad hoc groups were then set up to address those various categories of activity. It's all about an IP-based transport core using some fairly common and universal existing standards. For example, ISO BMFF, the OMA broadcast ESG, universal time, watermarking, all of those elements brought into the mix. So another way to look at it, we've got ATSC 1.0 on the left side of the screen. It was a broadcast-only network, MPEG transport, and broadcast applications stacked on. 2.0 brought in the broadband network aspect with IP and broadband applications. And as we see in the 3.0, it's a hybrid system where we have both broadcast and broadband with IP as the common transport to both, and hybrid applications that can accept data from both delivery systems. So S33, we've got ad hoc groups on service delivery and synchronization, on service announcement and personalization, and interactive services and companion screen, three different ad hoc groups. The applications and presentation layer, S34 activities. So essentially what this does is provide what the consumer experiences, flexible service models, video, audio, closed captioning, interactivity, all of the things, including emergency alerting, that the consumer will experience in the process. So what does a flexible service model entail? Well, certainly enhanced linear TV plus on-demand support, subscription, pay-per-view, conditional access, and digital rights management capabilities, both mobile and fixed delivery, plus companion device delivery, hybrid delivery using both networks to get the data there, automatic content recognition, flexibility for the future, flexible component delivery mechanisms, again, broadcast, broadband, high robustness as well as high bit rate. So we have the ability to, if you will, fall back if the signal isn't strong enough, but still receive content, but maybe we don't have everything in the delivery. Being able to deliver at different times, non-real time versus real-time continuous screens. The components can be dynamically combined at the receiver, perhaps even stored at the receiver, and you can integrate things like targeted advertising that might be pre-sent, and then you have a trigger that occurs for a commercial. Being able to look at, for example, different camera angles on an event. So here's just some kind of illustrations of a flexible service model where you've got closed captioning and interactive apps and other apps plus audio, and these can be dynamically selected by the receiver depending upon what path you have available to you. On the video side, being able to deliver high definition, we already do that, but also ultra high definition. And some of the high definition might be enhanced, meaning it's 60p instead of 1080i. Hybrid broadcast, again, high efficiency compression, the use of that. Multiple and selectable video components, so we can, again, do the camera angles, the multi-view, the multi-screen. To the companion devices. Audio, being able to personalize it, immersive, targeted to various devices, so you have different audio parameters for different devices that can be sent. Support for audio only, being able to, again, do hybrid versus hybrid meaning broadcast and broadband combined, and again, high-efficiency compression. And the additional services that get added in, including audience measurement and emergency alerting and accessibility, et cetera. So 34 is developed or broken into four different ad hocs, an ad hoc group on video, an ad hoc group on audio. The audio group just put out a call for proposals, so they're just getting ramped up. Presentation logic and framework and runtime environment. So let's look a little bit at content delivered in an IP world. This comes from the S34 folks. So we have applications that are essentially delivered as HTML. We have a broadcast file layer, we have a broadband file layer, and we have all this management stuff in between. And MPEG dash is a very important part of the file delivery. But bolted onto that is something called route. Here's a basic broadcast-only delivery. So we've got content flows that flow through the management layer and go up to the applications layer. And then we look at, for example, the idea of robust audio. You know, audio tends to fail before video in the current system. And one of the things that the broadcasters have said is, if all else fails and we get no video, at least we're going to get audio through there. So there's the ability through what are called PLP, physical layer pipes, where we can code at different rates and have different levels of robustness. Then we can have a very robust pipe that will deliver basic audio. It won't be 22.3 or 6 or whatever it is. It won't be 5.1. It may not even be stereo. It may just be a monaural audio track, but it'll be there if all else fails. And then we use another PLP to deliver the video and the audio. And we may even have scalable video encoding, which we'll see here in a bit. So a hybrid delivery system. We've got parts of the application layer information coming through the broadband pipe, while other parts come through the broadcast pipe. If we had layered encoding in the system, we could have a base layer. So let's say we have a less than desirable carrier to noise ratio at a given site. We might see the picture in, let's say, scaled back HD or maybe even SD. But if we have enough carrier to noise to be able to deliver full 4K, we would see that through the enhanced layer. And again, these are different PLPs that carry the elements of the coding. There was a recent demonstration by the Sinclair folks in Technicolor in Baltimore where they were showing scalable HEVC. First time it had been done in a broadcast environment, and that kind of tips us to what the future might hold for the video coding side. We got a lot of questions about how we're going to transition and how we deploy. And it usually begins with what's the timeline for ATSC 3.0. So planning actually began on 3.0 back in 2010. That's when some members of the industry began to recognize that the current ATSC system was getting sort of long of tooth and would not carry us into a competitive world going forward. So the planning got finished, and then we went off and spent about 2 years looking at what the requirements would be, what the broadcasters said they needed to be competitive in the world of tomorrow. In 2012, we began standards development work, and that's really scheduled to run through 2015. And then we would see products beginning somewhere around 2016. So today we are maybe a little bit further to the right of where that marker is, but we're well into the process of developing the standards within the specialty groups. The requirements, occasionally we go back and look at the requirements, verify that they're still valid, and in some cases we've reset priorities and honed a little bit, but by and large, the work that was done in 2011 to 2013 seems to be quite stable. So maybe we go back to that for a moment. So what happens at the end of this process? Well, we go to a candidate standard, and a candidate standard means that we don't have a standard yet. We've got all the documentation written, and we need to try it and verify that what we've proposed will work. So the candidate standard period usually is somewhere around 6 months or so. This gives people a chance to start building some prototype products and verify, and we put the signal on the air and do some testing and verify that what we've done is right. That goes to a ballot. It gets elevated to a proposed standard, which is kind of a short window. And then finally, it goes out and gets balloted by the entire ATSC. Again, one vote per member. Individuals, by the way, aren't members. Members are organizations. And there's one vote per organization. And that raises it to a standard. The current time frame is not for all three parts, all three layers, to be moved to candidate standard level at the same time, but all of that will be accomplished on the current timetable sometime in the latter part of 2015. So we've got a strong possibility by mid-2016 that we will have an actual standard. It will have been balloted and be in the full standard mode. Broadcasters within ATSC, within the board particularly, have looked at when this might actually get deployed, and we're hearing from broadcasters, some that are saying that they would expect to be on air by the middle part of 2018 with ATSC 3.0. So, hit the wrong button, there we go. So there are some challenges. We went from analog to digital, and at that point in time, we had enough spectrum that everyone had two channels. Unfortunately, we're not going to be in that mode to transition. So how might stations operate and make a transition? Well, some owners have duopolies in a market. This might be a case where stations have to start working together in a market and decide that if I own a station and you own a station, that one of us is going to make the transition to 3.0 and the other is going to stay in 1.0 for a period of time, and you're going to carry all of my programming plus your programming, and I'm going to carry all of your programming in 3.0, and over a period of time as receiver deployment hits a tipping point, eventually you would go off air with 1.0 and convert over to 3.0 and go back to your normal mode of operation. On the receiver side, many of the receivers today have USB capability, have HDMI capability, so there are USD stick tuner possibilities for solving the problem to convert. That would be a tuner, demodulator, perhaps a decoder. And one of the ways around that might be to initially begin broadcasting in MPEG-4 and then eventually transition to HEVC. Set-top boxes that could feed an HDMI connection to the receiver. There may be an industry-driven campaign to include tuners in portable devices such as tablets, laptops, smartphones. I think the industry will have to do that in order to make certain that they show up on the platforms that they're targeting. One of the groups, the core transmission group, has been looking at solving the, if you will, the coverage issues. Particularly if mobile is a high priority, which the broadcasters have said it is, It's likely that in many markets, first of all, it's pretty obvious we're going to keep the big stick that we've got. But in many markets, we might wind up with multiple repeaters, four repeaters in quadrants with directional antennas. These repeaters would be out near the noise-limited edge of the contour. Directional antennas beaming in towards the big stick, fairly wide patterns, maybe 150 to 170 degree patterns, with very, very good front-to-back ratios to the antenna. And be able to raise the average signal level across the contour. But not just for mobile, but also for being able to penetrate in-home, in-building type coverage, because you've got directional diversity that will get you there. And it's very possible that in a market that stations would get together and build these booster sites on a collaborative basis, meaning that you've got a common antenna, common transmission line, common tower, a combiner, and then multiple transmitters feeding those boosters. There's been some modeling done recently on one of the major stations on the East Coast, and that modeling showed a dramatic improvement in coverage, particularly for mobile, but also for in-building penetration. And the modeling was done using Longley Rice and using, I believe, 25% power level at the boosters versus the big stick. Okay, so you ask, well, does all this work? So let's go to a video that was put together here in the last couple days, and we'll find out, does it really work?
The advanced TV broadcasting system includes a basic requirement: advanced compression technology that will make it possible to deliver both ultra-high definition TV and mobile TV streams to future viewers. The fundamental requirement for a next-generation standard is a strong physical layer for ATSC 3.0 that will carry this payload through the broadcast transmitter to the receiver. In the future, viewers could be watching live TV on a curved-screen Ultra HD TV in the living room, or on a tiny mobile device equipped to receive live broadcast TV in any remote location. Developed by LG Electronics, its Zenith R&D subsidiary, and Gates Air, the FutureCast Universal Terrestrial Broadcasting System is designed to deliver a diverse mix of services to viewers within the same 6 MHz channel used today for ATSC 1.0. Testing at various sites in Madison, Wisconsin, through the facilities of Quincy Group's WKOW-TV, shows that FutureCast allows deep indoor reception for mobile devices and also 4K Ultra HD TV for the home. In fact, FutureCast has been shown to deliver 4K Ultra HD content and two robust mobile TV streams in a single channel. Nearly 50,000 pieces of data from scores of reception sites were recorded during the tests, including challenging reception areas inside buildings, in fast-moving vehicles, and locations from downtown to 50 miles from the transmitter. FutureCast is designed to both increase data throughput by 30% and improve multipath performance for fixed and portable TV reception. It can enable energy-saving features for consumer receivers, and it can be adjusted to deliver content at very high data rates, very robust transmission, or numerous combinations. FutureCast also utilizes HEVC advanced video compression, which efficiently supports video formats ranging from 4K UHD TV to lower resolutions intended for very small screen devices. The increased payload capacity of the physical layer combined with HEVC encoding will allow broadcasters many more options when planning their broadcast service offering. The FutureCast system is designed to fully meet broadcasters' requirements for the ATSC 3.0 physical layer and advances the goal of moving rapidly to next-gen broadcasting. In short, FutureCast is the ideal, complete solution for the ATSC 3.0 physical layer.
So that little commercial, if you will, and view of what just went on here in Madison, Wisconsin, is one of the proponents for the ATSC 3.0 physical layer. We're not claiming to be ATSC 3.0. We're really trying to show what the basic building blocks can do and what the system is capable of providing. So we did a demonstration at NAB in this year in April of 2014, where we showed a closed circuit demonstration of UHD, HD, and SD at different levels of robustness. That was almost the best way to describe it is a computer simulation. Although we had real streams flowing through the system, it was by no means broadcastable. Over the course of from late spring, when NAB was over, through late summer, our engineers were busy converting the technology into real hardware that could be deployed on a broadcast station. And when we had the NAB meeting, a good friend, Brady Dreisler. Brady's back here in the audience. Brady, put your hand up. Brady and I got together. I twisted his arm a little bit and said, is there a station within QNI that we might be able to test on? And he said, yeah, we've got this station in Madison that might be the ideal place. Madison's a great market for testing because it offers some terrain variances in various directions. But in addition to that, it happened to be fairly close to the guys down at Lincolnshire, where Zenith and LG are headquartered. So we began testing in the latter part of August. We had a number of nights where Brady Station went off the air at 1 o'clock in the morning, and we put a future cast signal up until 4 a.m. in the morning, and then turned the station back to normal broadcast service. During that period of time, we had a couple of vans. You saw one of them running around the market. We collected 50,000 data points in the market that we can analyze and be able to evaluate for the performance. We went into a number of buildings, some Walmarts at 3 o'clock in the morning, and various places, the Kohl Center and so forth, where we could test indoor. We went out 70 miles from the market, looking and characterizing the reception. So I'm going to give you a real quick update here on what we did on Tuesday night, Wednesday morning. Actually, it was really Wednesday morning, because at 1 o'clock Wednesday morning, we turned off WKOW's ATSC 1.0 signal and put 3.0 back up. We invited a number of people from the industry, as well as the attendees. We had a total of about 30 people that rode the bus with us. We had one of the industry experts ride the test van, Dennis Wallace from MSW. We went to a couple of different venues. We started out at WKOW, went to the Kohl Center. From there, we went to Pro Video, and then finally back here to the hotel, and we looked at different elements. At Pro Video, we went into a building that's totally metal. It's as Brady described it, it's a metal can. the stage door, also metal. We started out with the door open, kind of facing the direction of the transmitter, Brady, I think. Other way? Backside, okay. So we had some reflected signal apparently leaking in. And then we closed the door, and you could see on the spectrum analyzer the signal literally disappeared down to noise level. So what did we transmit? Well, we transmitted three different streams, a 4K UHD signal designed for fixed reception, 15.7 megabits of payload. The threshold of visibility was at 13.9 dB. The guard intervals all the way across on all three signals were 60 microseconds. Code rate was 80 over 15, and it was 256 QAM for modulation. 720p 60 signal, 1.25 megabits per second. 3.3 dB threshold of visibility. And if you compare that with the way most stations are running ATSC mobile today, they're running at about 6 to 6.5 threshold of visibility. So this is HD material, P60, HD material, at 3 dB better performance than today's mobile. And then you go to the standard definition, again, P60, and it was only 0.59 megabits of payload with a negative threshold of visibility, meaning that the noise is stronger than the received signal. So we started out, as I said, at WKOW. We had a kind of a briefing in the lobby. Wayne Luplow and myself and Joe Cecilia briefed the attendees. Most of the attendees were over by the food and kind of out of the picture at this point, getting their share of coffee because we were going to keep them up quite late. Here we are at the Kohl Center. That pizza pan is the ground plane for a quarter wave at channel 26. And that's connected to this blue box, which has the tuner, it has a noise generator, it has a group of attenuators and an amplifier for the signal. And that has an outboard decoder for HEVC driving a monitor. And we had a couple of reporters with us. One of them insisted on picking the tripod up and moving the antenna around, waving it around. This, by the way, is in a skybox, but our earlier testing actually was down on the floor at the Kohl Center. Tim Laud doing some of the demonstration, and of course it created quite a bit of interest. Then we moved over to Pro Video. We're in the studio, and we repeated the same thing, starting out with the door open, and then during the door close. And again, watching the spectrum analyzer, the signal got down to the point where the 3.3 dB TOV signal, the 720p HD, was there, but you could break it up if you move the antenna in the wrong direction. It was not as robust as the other signal. However, the standard definition signal was there and rock solid, unable to break it up. And on top of that, the cell phone coverage after the door was closed dropped off. So we were in an environment where there was no cell phone coverage at that time, but we had broadcast video, 480p, arriving with no problem whatsoever. And Brady, I think at that point we were about somewhere between probably 8 to 10 miles from the transmitter. Okay, good. Finally, we came back here to the hotel and we had a UHD demonstration, 4K, and that was with a received signal on an indoor antenna. The black box you see down there in the corner is the tuner. So the FutureCast signal is all about a file layer that has different PLPs, physical layer pipes, data pipes that can be coded at different levels, being able to take in different service components, bringing in signaling and bringing in emergency alert information in a very robust stream and being able to deliver those to devices. This is kind of what the exciter building block would look like. In the case of our testing, we took a current Gates Air M2X exciter. Brady has one of those for 1.0 in his current transmitter. And we put a second one in, but modified with some IP level input to it coming from a PC where we're doing the front end processing, the input formatting, the interleaving and so forth up to the modulation, and then doing the modulation within the M2X. So the system provides for both IP version 4 or version 6. It will also handle MPEG-2 transport and general data streams for future extensions. Very low transmission overhead, 2-byte baseband frame header, direct IP transport stream, and IP and transport stream header compression and deletion is capable. Using LDPC coding, that gets us very close to the Shannon limit. Here's again a look at the system at 15 dB. 15 dB was picked as a reference point because that's where ATSC 1.0 performs today. At 15 dB TOV, we can deliver 26.4 megabits of payload. So it's a 36% increase over the current ATSC system. has hierarchical signaling for fast information channel, allowing quick tuning, and also EAS delivery. So there are different levels of coding. Logical structure for the frame, emergency alert channel, as I mentioned, capabilities to wake up the receiver by detecting it in the preamble and waking up and then turning on the receiver and displaying a full cap message and related information. Very much future-proofed. That's one of the reasons why we call it future cast. It adopts the major minor channel versioning and changes in the system, but it also has future extension frames, FEF, which allow bolting on other systems. And one of the things that we showed at NAB, but didn't show it on our future cast system, but will eventually be there, is the ability to time division multiplex, an LTE signal with the broadcast signal. So if you were to look at this on a spectrum analyzer, you'd see the LTE signal at 5 megahertz bandwidth and the ATSC 3.0 signal at 6, and see it jumping back and forth and delivering to both types of waveforms. So quick overview here on some of the key features. Again, 30% increase in channel, system flexibility, very much improved robustness with the ability to go all the way down to negative carrier to noise levels. Fast discovery of the signals and services, improved use of single frequency network, and maximum bandwidth usage for within the spectral mask. So that's the overview of FutureCast. I will tell you that many of the other proponent systems are similar. They all have pretty much common building blocks, but there are some various tweaks between the various systems that are out there. So that's it. I'll open it up for questions.
Hi, Jay.
Hi, Kelly.
Quick question. What transport stream did you use for the demo? Was it the route?
We were actually not using either IP or MPEG transport. We were running raw data, basically right into the system at this point. That was just a simple way to get where we needed to be. And we'll have the ability to demonstrate the IP here shortly. There's a lot of work going on between the engineers. Okay, any others? Yes.
You have a waveform design that could be used at other parts of the radio frequency spectrum, especially with the four quadrant filler transmitters. And I'm wondering if you're, maybe you don't want to answer, giving any consideration to using other parts of the spectrum for this in case UHF becomes not available in the future for a terrestrial broadcast model?
Well, the fact is that the system has a lot of handles on it and can be optimized. We plan, the testing we've done here in Madison is just the beginning. We plan to do testing on high band V and low band V in other markets. So I think that's where you're headed. No? What parts of the band are you looking at? Okay, I don't know here in the U.S. whether we will ever see allocations. Kelly's probably a better guy to answer that one, but he's going, no, don't call on me. But right now, let's say that's not an area that anyone's focused on, because it's certainly not in the requirements that the broadcasters have laid out, and it's probably not likely, given what's going on with the spectrum battles between broadcast and the other folks, that we would ever get spectrum in those bands. Now that's not to say it wouldn't happen in other parts of the world. In fact, the NHK folks are talking about 4K delivery in, I think, up around 21 gigs or 20 gigs, something like that. Is that right, Kelly? So, you know, in other parts of the world it may happen, but that's not what we're focused on right now. Not to say that it wouldn't work there. Anyone else?
How does FCC approval work into all the candidate standard approval voting and such?
Well, the FCC looks at ATSC as the official standards organization. First of all, let me say that everything that we've done and that others have done in terms of testing, and there's more testing coming from other proponents, is done within the authorization of the FCC. So we have an STA that was granted to WKOW for the purpose of all of our testing. I think it's safe to say that it's in the FCC's best interest that they allow this to happen and eventually adopt 3.0 because it, again, makes the best use of the spectrum that's out there. If Chairman Wheeler is right about his words that he mentioned at NAB in April, you know, he wants to see broadcasting succeed. And this is the path we believe, and I think most others believe that this is the path to future success for broadcasting. So I don't see that it'll be a problem. The commission will look to ATSC for their adoption of the standard, and then it'll have to go through a process, I'm sure, but it won't be, I don't think it'll be challenged.
How do you get the consumer electronics industry involved? I mean, they don't even put program guides in the TV sets now, even though we send the information.
Consumer electronics industry is already involved. They are actively engaged in the process. If you look at many of the members that are chairing and active in this process, the big companies, Sony, Samsung, LG, they're all at the table. We've got representation from CE there. There'll be some CE committee work that's done to adopt on their side the activity. So I think the CE industry is just as excited about where this is going as the broadcast industry.
Yeah, I was just saying, because I mean, Mr. Shapiro's comments with the wireless in the auction have not been favorable to
us. What Gary says and what the members want may not always align. Gary tends to be a bit outspoken, but is that, am I being fair, Kelly? if the members of CE want this and they do, they'll make it happen. Yeah, Gary doesn't rule with an iron fist.
The other issue is, we're the only industry that doesn't control both ends of the pipe. You know, if you buy my satellite receiver, they come out and install a dish, they spec the equipment, the cell phone company, they're talking to your phone all the time.
Right.
You know, and we sit out there and throw it out and hope it sticks to the wall, and it just, you know, it's...
Well, that's why the process and the development ecosystem needs to include all the members of the ecosystem, not just some of the members. And when you have intellectual property in the process, we're not allowed to talk about intellectual property in ATSC, but when you have intellectual property involved, and some of that is owned by the CE folks, that will be an incentive for them to move forward. And I would say that we've got very good engagement from the broadcasters, we've got good engagement from the equipment manufacturers on the broadcast side, and we've got good engagement from the CE people in this process.
Do broadcasters have to get more involved in the consumer side? I mean, you used to have NBC and RCA going hand to hand, and it kind of drove the industry.
So I think their presence in ATSC sends a strong message to the CE community. If the broadcasters aren't fully engaged, the CE community takes note of that. But in this case, I came in at the latter end of the original ATSC development. That's when my job responsibilities at that point in time at Harris changed. But I believe there's probably more across the broadcast industry engagement today in the 3.0 development than there was in the original ATSC 1. Kelly's shaking his head, yes, in the original 1.0 development. Kelly's older than I am. He's been around. So, I would say that sends a strong message to the CE folks. Fred.
Mr. Adrick, could you talk a minute about who the members of the ATSC are and who has a vote? I understand, for example, the SBE is a member. I presume NAB is. I presume Gates Air is. I presume a number of people are. Do you have any idea how many members and votes?
Oh, I think it's up in the 160 right now, roughly 160 some members. It varies. Slack times, it got down to maybe 128, I think. I did membership for a while when I was on the board. I think 128 was kind of the bottom end, but it's well up into the 160 range. So the members are, first of all, you have to understand that it was formed by five organizations, which are called the JCIC members. Those five original members are the CE community, the National Cable Television Association, the NAB, the SMPTE group, and IEEE. Those are the five JCIC members. They have permanent seats on the board, and what happens is just the representation rotates depending upon who's the guy that draws the duty of that particular year. Then there are members from across the industry that build up and bring the board up to 15 members. Now, in the organization, in terms of membership, there are a number of broadcasters. I don't know the exact number, but it's quite high, as I said, right now. And there are broadcast-related organizations. Obviously, NAB is there, but you've got PBS, for example. You've got the major networks who also own stations are there. Then you've got the CE folks and a wide variety of CE folks. We're seeing specialty companies that have either IP or maybe might be in the chip business or have some area of technology. Qualcomm is a prime example, Nokia, those types of organizations are involved. We've got DVB as a member, believe it or not. They've had representation there. Then we've got some consultants who are there, some as observers and some as participants, people like Merrill Weiss and the Merrill Weiss Group. So it's a pretty much across the board collection. Companies like Imagine and Gates Air and other equipment manufacturers that participate. So again, a broad spectrum. If you go out to the ATSC.org site, I believe all the members are listed on the public side. So you don't have to be a member to find out who is part of the organization. It's a due process organization. It's one vote per membership. So you can't, other than consensus votes in an ad hoc group or a specialty group, it's one vote per organization. And you can't go in and stack the deck and, you know, bring 20 people from your organization and have 20 votes.
Please forgive me if this is a naive question, but I heard you speak about other proponents. If you're all working on ATSC-3, can we assume that all of these proponents are compatible, or are we going to have another war like we've had so many times about things in broadcasting over whose system we're going to use?
Well, what we have is the process starts out with the specialist group putting out a call for proposals. So, for example, the physical layer specialist group put out a call for proposals. The coding group, the presentation group, they put out call for proposals on video. Now they've just put one out for audio. So, in the initial call for proposals, there were, I think, 13 responses. One of them was disqualified. So now we were down to 12, but if you looked at the 12 proposals, some of them were pieces. Somebody had a piece of technology, they had the IP on it, they put that in as part of the system. I believe there were five or maybe six proposals that went beyond pieces and went to a proposal. FutureCast was one of several complete system proposals. Now, it doesn't mean that we expect all elements of FutureCast, for example, that might be adopted. Now, is there a lot of commonality? Well, sure. OFDM, I think, is pretty much common to every proposal that's out there. There's debate on what's the right coding to put on the physical layer. There's debate on the sequence of information in the signaling and what the preamble, for example, needs to contain and where, for example, the priority of the EAS signaling is versus something else. Those are all the things that get worked out in committees. We've been very careful to operate totally within the bounds and rules of the ATSC process. We were very, very clear to the group when we took them on the tour the other night that we're not trying to do an end run around the ATSC process. So the due process activities in ATSC have to rule. Anyone who thinks that they're going to create a standard outside of ATSC's process and have it adopted by members of the ecosystem, meaning the CE community, the FCC, the broadcasters, I think is been smoking something. Okay? They are not, they're not going to get the traction. In many cases, some of the things that you see in the press and the statements that are made, I would say is it's grandstanding, it's PR, it's trying to influence the group. But anyone who really thinks they're going to step outside the bounds and do something is wrong. We need to do one more thing. I'll be glad to do questions during lunch, but I need to invite Vanna White up. For the folks that endured 11:30 to 3:30 in the morning or later, we asked them to fill out a card, and we told them we would make it worth their while to be part of the bus tour.
Last chance for bribes.
So I couldn't get Vanna, but I got Chuck, so he's here, and he has to scramble the pile. And we have a very nice 42-inch LG, imagine that, it's not Samsung, an LG LED set. And Chuck has pulled out a lucky winner.
Leonard Charles.
Really? And he wasn't there. How about Mark Lemon of Iowa Public TV? Is Mark here? Or did he go home? Okay, very good, Mark. I have your information. I guess this address is your home address?
Yes.
Is that right? Well, we need to get your home address where you want it delivered. They will deliver it, and we'll get things back to LG, and hopefully in a week or two, you'll see a nice package on your doorstep. Congratulations. Thanks for the time. Enjoyed being here.